good afternoon. I'm Ann Kenny. I'm the Carl A. Kroc University Librarian at Cornell. And I want to extend a special welcome to the classes of Ought and Five. A 100 years ago, Samuel Clemens was the most famous man in the world. And he would probably be pleased to know that that fame endures. Mark Twain's best known and most beloved books have never gone out of print and exist in hundreds of editions and translations. Millions of American school children are still assigned his books every year, and I understand that there were 3 English classes this past fall with Twain on the reading list. Not only is Mark Twain famous, he's still controversial. A Huckleberry Finn consistently shows up on the American Library Association's list of frequently challenged books. I would guess that Twain would be pleased to be stirring up so much trouble 100 years later. The current exhibition in Cornell Library acknowledges Twain's fame as an author. And also as an American icon. Samuel Clemens managed the business of being Mark Twain, an image he deliberately and purposefully invented for himself during a time when American history was full of new opportunities that meant that men could go from poverty to riches overnight, when fame and wealth and success must have seemed perpetually around the corner. He even coined the term we all use for that era, the Gilded Age. Samuel Clemens deeply loved the idea of the self-made man, making his own way in the world, building his future on the force of his own ideas, his own inventiveness, and his own creativity. And for lack of a better term, he worked it. He capitalized on his fame eagerly, branching out far beyond writing to become an inventor, an entrepreneur, a publisher, even a creator of board games. And he fantasized about becoming a millionaire. Samuel Clemens essentially invented and sold Mark Twain. Our new exhibit, titled Known by Everyone, Liked by All, explores Samuel Clemens' relationship with business and, more deeply, his relationship with himself as a brand, as a commodity that could be trademarked and sold. He was the first American to try to trademark his pen name, taking his case to court to protect his royalties abroad, but losing the first round. 30 years later, and 2 years before his death in 1910, he did manage to trademark the name Mark Twain Company so that his heirs could collect book royalties even after his bankruptcy. The exhibition features an amazing range of Twain's written work, including first editions of nearly all of his books and stories, original handwritten letters — he was a prolific writer — and the very last manuscripts written just days before his death. But it also focuses on the management of his own brand using artifacts such as games and cigars that help explain how he and others tried to capitalize on his fame. Someone very familiar to Cornellians may deserve some credit for setting Samuel Clemens on this path: Henry Sage. One of Cornell's most prominent benefactors in its early years and president of the Board of Trustees, Sage was also a former business partner of Clemens' father-in-law. In his autobiography, Mark Twain writes that Sage told him, "Mr. Clemens, you've got as clear a business head on your shoulders as I have come in contact with for years. What are you doing as an author? You ought to be a businessman." This exhibit documents both sides of that Twain coin. This exhibit would never have been possible without the generosity of Susan Jaffe Tane, whose collection of Mark Twain's rare books, letters, photographs, and artifacts formed the nucleus of our exhibit, and who provided the funding for this event. Susan Tane's collection has been brought to life by Cornell librarian and exhibits curator Lance Heidick, whose enthusiasm and skillful research uncovered many of the stories that link Mark Twain to Cornell. Lance, who is also the editor of this really fabulous printed catalog of the exhibit, is deeply grateful to the generous community of Twain scholars, and there's a lively bunch of them, to the team of librarians, conservators, digital imaging specialists, web designers, and other library staff members who worked for the past year to make this exhibit possible. I'm also here to introduce our reunion speaker, Dan McCall. The library's reunion lecture is the kickoff of a series of events this weekend hosted by the many libraries on campus. Over the next few days, there will be open houses and tours at various libraries, workshops on such topics as finding your ancestors in cyberspace, strategies for conducting online legal research using free and low-cost sources, building better business plans, strategies for research for entrepreneurs, online resources for book lovers, a film festival at the Math Library, kind of boggles the mind, a presentation on the Nuremberg trials at the Law Library, a tour of the historic A.D. White Library, resources on databases that are available to alumni. But it all begins here with the library's reunion lecture, followed by a reception and exhibition viewing in the Kroc Library. It is my pleasure to welcome Cornell's own icon, Dan McCall, Professor Emeritus of English and American Studies. Professor McCall joined the Cornell faculty in 1966 and taught here for 40 years. Some of you may have even taken a class from him. His course on modern American literature was one of the most popular courses in the English department, which often packed in 200 or more students. Professor McCall is well known not only as an inspiring teacher, but also as an author. His critical and scholarly books include The Example of Richard Wright, The Silence of Bartleby, and the Norton critical edition of Melville's short novels. His book on Nathaniel Hawthorne and Henry James, Citizens of Somewhere Else, was called a splendid new book by Publishers Weekly for offering a salutary balance between traditional and innovative approaches to literature. He also wrote many novels, including Triphammer and Jack the Bear, which has been translated into a dozen languages. Jack the Bear was also made into a feature movie starring Danny DeVito as John Leary, a recently widowed father with an alcohol problem and two young sons. The film received 3 stars by noted film critic Roger Critter, Roger Ebert, and viewer reviews of the movie on Amazon ran the gamut from "This film has had a gigantic impact on my life" to "I did not get to see this movie because my mailman stole it." Professor McCall has said about his style that maybe my tone is too chatty, my voice on the page is my voice in the classroom. That is the way I teach. You don't have to learn some new abstruse vocabulary. I can't imagine a more fitting speaker to honor Mark Twain and to entertain and inform Cornell's returning alumni than Dan McCall, the man who has taught the adventures of Huckleberry Finn to generations of Cornellians with his chatty tone. The title of his talk is a stunner, All Full of Tears and Flap Doodle, The Genius of Mark Twain. So, please.
A joke can backfire. You say something you thought was funny, and instead of a laugh, you get an icy, silent stare. My all-time favorite example of this calamity is Mark Twain's speech at Whittier's 70th birthday banquet in Boston, December 17th, 1887, Mark Twain succeeded in making as shining an ass of himself as at any time over the long course of his life. And it led to a thunderbolt of shame and remorse. On that fateful winter night, Mark Twain ran headlong into his own profound ambivalence about civilization, capital S. He was 42, the wild humorist of the West, and the result was so damned embarrassing that he brooded about it for the rest of his life. Is this thing working? Can everybody hear me? Should I talk louder or not so loud? Is that okay? He had been put under instruction not to shock the August company by making fun of cherished ideals. So, of course, he did exactly that. And thus, Ron Powers suggests, he unwittingly inaugurated a venerable institution of American popular culture, the celebrity roast. Tribute after tribute, far into the night. And finally, Clemens rose and spoke of a time when he was still a young writer out west, and being callow and conceited, he resolved to try the value of my nom de plume. I knocked at a miner's lonely log cabin in the foothills of the Sierra just at nightfall. A jaded, melancholy man of 50, barefooted, opened to me. When he heard my nom de plume, he looked more dejected than ever. "You're the fourth. I'm a going to move." "The fourth what?" said I. "The fourth literary man that's been here in 24 hours. I'm a going to move." "You don't tell me," said I. "Who are the others?" He replied, "Mr. Longfellow, Mr. Emerson, and Mr. Oliver Wendell Holmes. Dad, fetch the lot." Emerson, Longfellow, and Holmes, all three, were seated right there at the head table in the banquet hall. And Mark Twain had his miner describe them all grotesquely, especially Holmes. Quote, "fat as a balloon. He weighed as much as 300 and had double chins all the way down to his stomach." And then the miner reports that the stuffed shirts began to recite their own most well-known poems. Mark Twain then did a series of riffs on them, garbling and switching things around. Emerson, for example, "they know not well the subtle ways I keep and pass and deal again instead of turn again. They're cheaters, card sharks. The miner says, they'd been drinking, I could see that. The young Mark Twain feebly interrupts, why, my dear sir, those were not the gracious singers to whom we and the world paid loving reverence and homage. These were imposters. The miner gets the kicker. Ah, imposters were they? Are you? It didn't go over so well. Years later, Mark Twain remembered that the faces of the audience turned to a sort of black frost. He gamely continued, waiting for somebody, anybody, to laugh, at least smile, but nobody did. William Dean Howells, the master of ceremonies, said the speech provoked only a silence weighing many tons to the square inch. Even worse, a delicious detail. The stony silence was broken only, Howells added, by the hysterical and blood-curdling laughter of a single guest. Howells had to lead Mark Twain away to suffer alone in his hotel room. Howells called the speech a bewildering blunder, a cruel catastrophe. Mark Twain felt the awfulness of what he was doing, but he was fatally helpless to stop. It was a case of demoniacal possession. 10 days later, Mark Twain wrote a letter of abject apology to the three worthies he had so hideously slandered. Gentlemen, I come before you now with the posture of the guilty, not to excuse, gloss, or extenuate. I did it as innocently as I ever did anything. But when I perceived what it was I had done, I felt as real a sorrow, I suffered as sharp a mortification as if I had done it with guilty intent. This continues as to my wife's distress. It is not to be measured, for she is of finer stuff than I, and yours were sacred names to her. We do not talk about this misfortune. It scorches, so we only think and think. I will end now. I had to write to you for the easement of it. I ask you to believe that I am only heedlessly a savage, not premeditatively. And he signs off with great and sincere respect. The newspapers took it up. Banner headlines. Mark Twain's offense against good taste. Mark Twain's mistake at the Whittier dinner. And for 30 years, he kept on arguing with himself about it. Quote, nobody has ever convinced me that the speech was not a good one. I could as easily have substituted the names of Shakespeare, Beaumont, and Ben Johnson. My purpose was clean, my conscience clear. As late as 1906, he was still fussing about it. I have read it twice, and unless I am an idiot, it hasn't a single defect in it from the first word to the last. It is just as good can be. It is smart. It is saturated with humor. There isn't a suggestion of coarseness or vulgarity in it anywhere. But a few days later, I have examined that speech a couple of times since and have changed my mind about it, changed it entirely. I find it gross, coarse. I don't like any part of it from the beginning to the end. I always found it offensive and detestable. How can I account for this change of view? I don't know. I can't account for it. I expect this latest verdict to remain. But then there's a little footnote in his handwriting. May 25th, 1906. It did remain until day before yesterday. Then I gave it a final and vigorous reading aloud and dropped straight back to my former admiration of it. Sometimes in his work, he divides himself into two voices. In Roughing It, he's the tenderfoot and the old-timer. In Life on the Mississippi, he's the pilot and the passenger. He's a professional schizophrenic. Most famously and gloriously exemplified in Huckleberry Finn's self-indictment, I was playing double. Often the critics provide a specious etymology that twain means double, when of course it comes from the nautical measurement Mark Twain, 2 fathoms, 12 feet. The triumph of the book is that both languages live at once in the same boy. His conscience talks to him in cultural platitudes, and it was a close place, which he escapes from by saying, "All right, then I'll go to hell." Arthur Schlesinger Jr. concludes, "This, I would suggest, is what America is all about." Well, you wouldn't conclude that today. Teachers encourage students to approach the work not so much as literature, but as a battleground in the American culture war. In the preface to the 3rd edition of the Norton Critical, we are asked at the very beginning, "Is Adventures of Huckleberry Finn a racist book?" It's not a real question, merely a rhetorical one, because just below we read, quote, "Mark Twain uses a single demeaning racial epithet more than 200 times in the book. Make no mistake about it, this is Huck's or Mark Twain's name calling." The Norton editor's elbow is always in our ribs. Quote, Huck's separation from Jim in a dense white, no less, fog, as opposed, I guess, to the usual vermilion fog. In an appended essay, a public school official calls the book the most grotesque example of racist trash ever written. The new Norton even includes with agonizing frequency the original illustrations, which Mark Twain himself had reservations about, by Edward Windsor Kemble, who went on to achieve fame with his Comical Coons and A Coon Alphabet. In the McCarthy period, CBS television produced a version in which Jim was left out entirely. One politically correct example I always ask my students to consider is this exchange late in the book between Huck and Aunt Sally, when Huck says the steamboat blowed out a cylinder ahead. And she responds, good gracious, anybody hurt? No'm, killed a nigger. Well, it's lucky because sometimes people do get hurt. In a 1997 program on the Learning Channel, the dialogue is ever so slightly amended to, good gracious, anybody hurt? No'm. Well, it's lucky because sometimes people do get hurt. Are we to believe that Mark Twain, surely one of the most wonderfully wicked writers ever to walk the earth, didn't know what he was doing? In Uncle Tom's Cabin, racism is demonized in Simon Legree. Huckleberry Finn shows us that the unconscious racism of the sweet Aunt Sally's is a pervasive cultural pathology. Every year here at Cornell, it got harder for me to teach the book. And in my final 5 years, I was the only English professor to teach it. I received anxious memos and visits from colleagues who passionately urged me not to say nigger out loud in my lectures. Say, They said some words are too painful to hear, and we are trying to create a mutually supportive community. They were very disappointed when I replied that I think it's swell to create a mutually supportive community, but I've been laboring under the impression that Cornell is a university where you are supposed to tell the truth. Mark Twain remembered from his boyhood that the saddest faces I have ever seen were those of slaves chained together and lying on the streets waiting to be sold. Late in his life, when he established a scholarship for black students at Yale Law School, he wrote, "We have ground the manhood out of them, and we should pay for it. Huck is a buddy novel, and one of its greatest lines, almost never mentioned, is when Huck sings out to Jim as the slave hunters approach, "They're after us. Us." The way you talk is who you are. In Huck Finn, the poetic, the real language of love and romance is anti-poetic. Huck loves Mary Jane so much that the first draft statement, "You could depend on her like the everlasting sun and stars every time," becomes, in the final draft, "She had more sand in her than any girl I ever see. In my opinion, she was just full of sand." Or what I always think of as one of the finest sentences in the book. After the death of his newfound friend, Huck says, "I cried a little when I was covering up Buck's face, for he was mighty good to me." It's a richly iambic line, honest self-interest. I didn't love him because he was good, but because he was mighty good to me. You don't weep, you cry a little. We're ready to go back to the river. All that needs to be expressed has been said. One of the funniest lines Mark Twain ever made was to a newspaper reporter who asked him, "What caused the Civil War?" Mark Twain replied, "Sir Walter Scott." And in Life on the Mississippi, he expanded on the Sir Walter disease that raced like a plague through the Old South with its sham grandeurs, sham goads, and sham chivalries. No wonder the foundered steamboat in Huck Finn, that wreck laying there so mournful and lonesome, is the Walter Scott. Mark Twain loathed the showiest kind of book talk that made chivalry a drive toward death. He found a version of it in his native grounds in the work of James Fenimore Cooper's Leatherstocking Tale, which he said delightfully, "Cooper saw nearly all things as through a glass eye darkly." It's Tom Sawyer, not Huck, whose chivalric nonsense. Tom's mind is exquisitely, obsessively, helplessly literary. Note the little passage in chapter 38 about all that coat of arms business, in which Tom designs, quote, "a crest, a runaway nigger, sable, with a bundle over his shoulder, on a bar sinister, and a couple of ghouls." It's a prank. It's a mischievous rift on the last line of the Scarlet Letter. On a field sable, the letter A, ghouls. That is, what we discover in the best of Mark Twain is a war between official, high, literary language and subversive, low, colloquial speech. Now that we have the long-lost manuscript, we can see him doing it in the very first sentence. He rewrites it at least three times, moving from "you will not know" to "you do not know," at last, "you don't know." Lars Rouzeff is right. To read Mark Twain's work is to hear it. For me, the most interesting single word in the book is trash. In the table of contents, it's the last word of chapter 15, trash. Throughout, I love what Huck does with words, like yellocution and diseased for deceased. Mortification set in, and they had to amputate him. Well, trash is my favorite. Critics go wild with it. And high on my list of world's worst footnotes is this one. Trash. Jim calls Huck by the most contemptuous term slaves had for white men, white trash. Now, there are two things seriously wrong with that. First, yes, Harriet Beecher Stowe used it in 1855 once, but its appearance in common speech and in literature was way later, almost all in the 20th century. And two, it's not at all in Jim's character to call Huck that. He'd never say it. Huck is pointing to the trash on the raft from the storm. Literally nature's trash, not the slaveholders of the South. We have to be careful with the language. Which way does the irony cut? And against whom? What do we do with the words Huck utters when Tom Sawyer agrees to help steal Jim free? When Tom does exactly what Huck wants him to do, Huck says, "Tom Sawyer fell considerable in my estimation." Michael Patrick Hearn claims that no other living work of American literature has suffered so contradictory a history. Huckleberry Finn is banned from today's Cornell English department, but that's nothing new. When the book was first published, it received a host of negative reviews. A mass of rubbish, more suited to the slums than to intelligent, respectable people. The veriest trash. Louisa May Alcott wrote, "If Mr. Clemens cannot think of something better to tell our pure-minded lads and lassies, then he had better stop writing for them." Calling the book indecent, the Concord Public Library banned it. Here we go again. The Whittier birthday dinner. Political correctness, all full of tears and flapdoodle. Approved high culture will not listen to colloquial exposure of its cowardice and hypocrisy. The royal nonsuch, ladies and children not admitted. As the Duke says, if that don't fetch them, I don't know Arkansas. I'll conclude with trash. Huckleberry plays a mean trick on Jim. Huck pretends to believe in Jim's habit of interpreting dreams. Huck has convinced Jim that he's only dreamed what happened earlier that night in a storm. But Huck's really just setting Jim up for a big fall. Triumphantly, Huck points to the leaves and rubbish on the raft and crows, "What does these things stand for?" Slowly, Jim realizes he's been had. Then he finally looks at me steady without ever smiling and answers the question, "What do they stand for? I's going to tell you. When I got all wore out with work, with calling for you, and went to sleep, my heart was most broke because you was lost. I didn't care no more what become of me and a raft. And when I wake up and find you back at Yuna all safe and sound, the tears come, and I could have got down on my knees and kissed your foot. I was so thankful. And all you was thinking about was how you could make a fool of old Jim with a lie." And then, entirely free of any sentimental poetry involving darky primitive wisdom, for there's way too much sting in it, "That truck there is trash. And trash is what people is that puts dirt on the head of their friends and makes them ashamed. Racist trash." Listen to that last sentence. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard a human being say.
Some questions. Yeah. Did you all hear the question?
No.
The gentleman asked about Twain's relationship with a young ingenue named Laurie.
Laura. Yeah, it's very funny. I don't mean it's funny. I mean it's strange and beautiful and very odd. He knew her when she was 17. He was in love with her, but nothing came of it. He was still too young, and didn't seem like a good possibility as a husband, and the mother moved the girl away, but he dreamt about her frequently all through his life. You remember that, the lost Laura, the love of his life. That's all I know.
So the question focuses on Mark Twain cultivating the sense of celebrity, and is it the precursor to Hemingway and his cultivation?
Well, Mark Twain was the most popular writer, as you said in your introduction, in the 19th century. I was astonished when I wanted to teach Hemingway, I was told that no, he's a male chauvinist pig. He's probably, you know, political correctness is always coming at you. My God, can you imagine 20th century American prose fiction without the influence of Papa Ernest Hemingway? He influenced everybody. He created a model of the most beautiful, terse. He's the most revolutionary writer of the 20th century. And the idea that, but then I got in trouble with my colleagues, of course, I taught on Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and Faulkner. And I remember a young woman standing up in class and asking me why we had to teach these anti-feminist, racist, and I said, no, they're just a trio of drunks.
Twain's language and subject matter are so quintessentially American. To what do you attribute his popularity in all kinds of countries overseas that would not necessarily have that link with the U.S.?
So how do you account for Twain's popularity overseas because the language and the American culture is so critical?
Well, I wonder when I was preparing this talk and looking over what I taught and taken for granted, and I remembered one of the most beautiful memories of my childhood is when my mother and father took turns reading me at bedtime Huckleberry Finn. And Dad was great on the funny stuff, and Mom was great on the tight stuff. And I just loved it, but I don't think I had a literary sense. Gosh, I was 8 years old. Mark Twain is a wonderful storyteller. You can translate him all over the world. It's so exciting, the stories he tells. Though, you must know and realize how beautiful his sense of language is. I was going to get in trouble. Shelley Fisher Fishkin has a book called Was Huck Black? And I wanted to review it for Epoch Magazine. I was just going to say, was Huck Black? Only if you're deaf, dumb, and blind. But But they wouldn't let me. But you do notice when you read Huck and Jim talking, there's a great difference between their languages. They'll use like 10 words in common, and each will say it a little differently. Mark Twain has such a great ear for various dialects, and I loved it before I knew how funny a lot of it was. He's very engaging. He's a powerful writer. They took my breath away, my parents. Both of them, of course, were college professors. I remember at the 10th anniversary of the Willard Strait takeover by the black students, a black student of mine said, "You know, it tore this campus apart. There were so, oh gosh, terrible things." And the student said to me, "Dan, which side were you on?" And I said, "Oh, of course." And then he said, "No, Dan, which side were you on?" And I said, "Absolutely." And then he said, "Dan, we're talking about reality here." And I said, "Look, bro, if I wanted to deal with reality, I wouldn't have become a college professor."
Do I hear a question about whether Jim was white? In the back. Her comment was, "Huck Finn may be dead in the English department, but he's alive and well in the history department."
Of course, on race and popular culture, and we read Huck Finn every year, not only because of the issue of race, but also because I consider him one of the first black men by stand-up comedians. And I think you can trace a lot of his approach to his audience, to some of the comedians, Lenny Bruce, Bill Cosby, even Richard in spite of all of the ups and downs it's gone through since it was published.
Well, it's funny when you teach, are you teaching values? Yes. As you notice, I like to say, what's the best this? What's the best that? What's the worst? All that. Well, the best teaching of writing that I know was by my spiritual father, M.H. Abrams, The Mirror and the Lamp, Mike Abrams, and he wrote the best comment on a student's paper I've ever heard. He gave a freshman seminar the original topic, "What I did on my summer vacation." And one young boy from Reno wrote about how he went prospecting for gold, but his burro kept running away with his pick and pans and shovels, and he misspelled burro, B-U-R-R-O-W. And Mike Abrams, the greatest critic I know, just wrote one sentence at the bottom of the paper: "Your problem is You don't know your ass from a hole in the ground.
Please join me in thanking again Dan McCulloch.